Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. Episode 1, The Bone Orchard. We're your hosts,
Dwayne DeFreitas
and Andrew Sarsini. And this week we have Tosin Anifowakin with us. Tosin is our regular co-host on The Drill Down, our tech-themed podcast. We just watched the first episode of Starz American Gods titled The Bone Orchard. We assume you have as well, so total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk. But before we do, we want to catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. You can write us an email or a voice memo at godspodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at godspodcast or just hashtag the dominant paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods, and you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. Add us on iTunes, like us, and please leave us a review. Dwayne, if you will, would you please give us a brief recap of what we saw in tonight's episode?
You got it. So this is the pilot. A lot of stuff happens in pilots. Yeah. Everyone remembers our Westworld podcast. So the show opens up with a man with a quill writing coming to America, and the scene transitions into one of Norsemen coming to America sometime before Leif Erikson. They had an awful time of it, and they attempted lots of sacrifices to their gods to gain the kinds of resources like wind and food and stuff needed to head home. Eventually, they do head home, and they never return. The narrator says that when Leif, son of Erik the Red, shows up decades later, he finds his gods already waiting. That's kind of this kind of separate preamble to what we're about to see. We're then introduced to Shadow Moon in prison. He gets out of prison 3 days earlier than his sentence is supposed to be, because his wife has died in an auto accident. On his way home to the funeral, he begins to understand life on the outside. He meets a man who calls himself Wednesday, who offers him a job. He declines. His plane is rerouted, and he rents a car to drive to the funeral. He runs into the same guy Wednesday at a bar and learns of his best friend's death, and the same car crashes his wife. And the job he was supposed to have was with his best friend, who's now dead, won't be able to employ him. So he accepts a job with Wednesday as his kind of aide-de-camp, manservant. And then he also meets Mad Sweeney. They're in a bar, and Sweeney is this tall Irish-seeming man. They end up having a brawl, and he learns a coin trick from Mad Sweeney and acquires a golden coin from him. The next day, he's pretty hungover. He attends a funeral of his wife, where he learns that his wife was actually having an affair with his best friend, and that she died giving him fellatio while in the car that crashed that killed them both. He drops the coin that Mad Sweeney gave him on the grave, and we see it sucked down. And on his way away from there, after kind of confronting the wife of his best friend who was having an affair with his own wife, he's accosted by a dude in a limousine, and he's nearly lynched by that guy's henchmen, who are bloodily killed. And that's kind of where the pilot ends. So it's kind of all over the place. There's this scene in the beginning. There's prison. There's, you know, death of his wife. There's this Wednesday dude. There are bar brawls. There's a funeral. And then he's almost killed later randomly. So a lot going on in that stuff. What do you guys think are the most salient points that struck out to you?
Well, there's a lot of interesting things. There's a lot of hanging imagery in this episode. Should we talk about that, Tosin?
So, yeah, we see a lot of hanging imagery throughout this episode. The first, we see Norse men who hung someone for their god's favor. They're trying to get wind back so they can sail back, and they think hanging an individual will grant them the favor they need to get strong winds. We see the inmates who want to lynch Shadow. They, you know, run their fingers across their throats, and they also show a hanging rope. Loki, also in the prison, tells Shadow that, you know, the country went to hell when it stopped hanging people. And finally, at the very end, as Dwayne noted, we actually see Shadow getting lynched at the end, and he's himself is actually hung.
Yeah, that was pretty jarring, rain and lynching and all that. Speaking of the lynching, it was pretty stylized, right? Like, there's a lot of kind of concrete stuff in there. Like, when his cellmate is telling him about, you know, how to deal with the airport and other stuff, there's, like, kind of very, like, focused and kind of I would say, concrete images. But when certain things happen, and it kind of feels super stylized. So at first, we've got these this Norseman. They come over, and the first thing that happens is this dude gets like shot with like a million arrows. It's like not realistic at all. And then you've got, during that scene, the men have to fight one another to kind of sacrifice to their gods or whatever. There's like 300 style blood, like the film based on the Frank Miller graphic novel, just like blood, super red, splashing, flying everywhere. There's a flying arm, goes in
slow mo as well too, in elements.
So much slow mo. Yeah. Right, exactly. When you're in the prison, there's a super large prison window, which seems like not a thing, like who cares, but at the same time, like, a lot of these like high-end, high-production shows care so much about realism, and I feel like he had like a bay window in his prison cell, and it kind of just showed that, like, for me, it was kind of like, is it like a symbol of him getting out, or like he's a daydreamer, whatever. I don't know. It was just like super large. And then the look of his cellmate, like he has these like interesting kind of fangy-looking teeth. Like his face looks almost like rubber. It was very odd. And then you've got Shadow in contrast, who is a pretty big guy. Mm-hmm. But he kind of seems mundane. And then when you look at his other cellmates, you know, they're much bigger, and they're kind of always in slow motion as well. Here's the noose I'm holding, all that stuff. You get to the bar fight, you know, it kind of happens suddenly, but they're all over the place. Glasses are flying, people are flying all over the place. You know, suddenly Mad Sweeney is looking like an Irish guy out of Gangs of New York, out of nowhere. Yeah. There's a lot going on there. Tosin, you have some stuff too when it comes to the stylistic, right?
Right. So there's one thing that I noticed was, of course, you know, technology. There's the technology boy's limo, which is like this kind of like little cube that Shadow pokes, and it turns into this robot and sucks him into this world,
like a VR helmet. Almost.
Yeah, exactly. And then everything sort of like digitally like evolves and appears for mm-hmm. him. So that was kind of interesting and very unique. Andy, anything about that too that stood out?
Yeah, and you get to the Technology Boy himself, who is you know, this super young looking snot-nosed kid. And he's got his minions, and his minions are partially
faceless.
They're faceless, and they're partially digitized. They look completely like they're digital constructs, like avatars. And
yeah, while he has like ice cream cone hair and, you know, like orange. Right. Or red.
His body keeps on changing too, right? Like the mm-hmm. technical person. Like, right. His body, like, it kind of becomes, like, the face he shows Shadow doesn't seem like it's completely his real face. You know what I mean?
Right, right, right. It's definitely the personification of new media, and I don't know whether that is part of the artifact of this sort of pseudo-VR helmet that he's wearing, or if that's Technical Boy's actual personification itself.
That VR helmet observation is really powerful. I didn't think about that. I know the thing jumped on his face like a face hugger, but my alien, you know, the alien from 1979, that kind of face hugger thing, mm-hmm. as a geek, that's the first thing I thought of. But yeah, there's a certain virtual reality aspect to that, which would help explain why it's so stylized. But then at the same time, those guys become pretty real pretty soon.
Right,
at least
right.
for Shadow.
Yeah, yeah. So at the end of that episode, he's ejected from this this limo, where essentially the VR helmet pops off of his head, and he goes he is lynched. And then
you should say he survives.
He survives. He's lynched, and he hangs there for a while until the rope breaks, and he lands. And he gets the crap kicked out of him by Technical Boy's minions, faceless minions. Right. When all of a sudden,
it's an internet mob, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's an internet.
It's like a flash mob, right?
It's funny. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, you're right. And then those guys are torn to shreds out of nowhere by someone or something that we do not see.
And it's all slow mode. It's all like the stylization is like it's slow mo, not on like 300 again, and like the rain is like stippled or whatever. You know, it's kind of like out of focus as it falls.
It's like a John Woo like movie, but
that's actually it reminds me of like the Matrix rain, right? In some of those fight scenes that they had,
right? In the like the later episodes of the sequels, the Matrix sequels particularly, right?
Right, where it's like dark and it's like dreary, and you're seeing the action evolve through it, combined with, as you mentioned, sort of the 300 blood splatter and work as that's going all over the place.
Yeah,
it feels it has this feel of like what's reality and what's not.
I think it's definitely very evocative of something like a John Woo, and also consistent with the previous work of Brian Fuller, like Hannibal. It's got a very highly stylized look to it. Let's move on to the dreams that we see in this episode, particularly Shadow's dreams. So the first thing that we see in the episode, dream-wise, is we see a Shadow. He's in his cell, and he's thinking about his wife, Laura, and then he pictures her. The world around him falls away, and he sees Laura in front of him, although he's lying on his cell, and he's looking up at the ceiling, and he's seeing her as if she is, in front of him looking down, and she's speaking to him. And I think that's the moment that I feel like, in retrospect, after we realize that she's passed, she's dead, I think that's the moment that she died, is when Shadow sees her in his dream.
Yeah, you know, at the very beginning of that scene, I look at that and I thought, that kind of break in the wall, that crack in the wall, very much reminded me of, I want to say, season 5 of Doctor Who, when
the Matt crack.
Smith Doctor first meets Amy Pond as a child, and that crack in the wall is right there, and Prisoner 00 whatever is kind of sneaking through, but that crack is stuck in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like Shadow's view is one that's, he can see through the cracks, sort of, for whatever is special about him allows him to see important things in his dreams. I mean, Tosin, you've got another dream you want to talk about, right?
Yeah, so I think immediately afterwards, one of the next dreams you see is Shadow, who's walking through this sort of like boneyard forest, and you know, it has trees that start to scratch him, and after he gets through, he sees this sort of bison with, I think it was smoke and maybe some smoke coming out of like its mouth, and I think it also had like flames coming out of its like eyes. And you know, I think we presume that this is really what's giving the episode's title, the Bone Orchard, but you don't really hear too much about it. It kind of is something that occurs and then kind of disappears. So I'm really curious, giving the listeners out there sort of my experience. I'm only a recent reader of the books, the book American God. So I'm pretty fresh on this entire series.
Yeah, and then also, like, you know, in that boneyard, there's like one very specific thing in it. In fact, the bison kind of comes around this huge tree. And we see it. We see this whole situation twice. We've got this bone orchard. Maybe it's an orchard because the tree is there, and the tree is like anamorphic, right? Like it can move. And it scratches him at one point. And I mean, obviously, this is not happening in the reality. But where is it happening? Why is it happening? What does it mean? Yada yada yada. That's one of the things that I think is also strange. There was also like dream on the plane, right? So like on the plane when Shadow's dreaming during the storm, I also got the feeling that that's when Laura died. So you think that Laura died when he was in the cell?
Yeah, and because
I kind of feel like Laura maybe died when he was on the plane.
Because we don't.
No, no, she couldn't. No, he's remembering. He has like a. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Obviously, he can't have died when he was on the plane. He got released early because she died. So there was kind of this moment when like he's kind of like imagining or dreaming about what it must have been like for her to die.
Right.
Kind of like flying through the air. There's kind of like glass and water kind of moving around her body. She almost looks peaceful. But they devote a significant amount of the pilot to sort of Shadow's dream state. And it's not like lucid dreaming. It's, with the exception of the whole boneyard and the tree, it's very much like, I have no control of what's going on here. And I'm just very confused about what's going on. You know, like he's having these kind of like very strange visions while he's unconscious. So that was pretty interesting. But that said, the significance of dreams is also pretty interesting, right? You know what I mean? Like the idea that, you know, why is he dreaming so much? And with the dreams, they kind of transition them from reality into dream state. There's no like, it's not like in the 40s where they kind of like make the screen look like it's water. You know, like, oh, we're in a dream situation. It kind of, I don't know what that's called. Dissolve, maybe? I don't know. But
yeah,
they definitely...
Ripple dissolve is usually what we call it in the,
okay,
in the business.
Nice. There's no ripple dissolve. It just happens. He's like, yeah, sitting in his cell. His eyes are like, you know, he's about to go to bed. And like the wall opens up and there's his wife. And he's talking to her as if they have some sort of like, you know, Jean Grey Cyclops rapport.
Right. Yeah, you know, you're really correct there, because it blends together so much that quite a lot of the episode you could question whether or not what we're seeing is reality or if it's just a dream, right? Even the things with like technology boy, right? That sort of stuff seemed could have been kind of dream-esque. He's in a whole nother world. Everything sort of melds together. We notice, you know, this lady that I think we'll chat a little bit about, who is like having sex with this guy, and like, is that reality? What's going on there, or is that a dream?
That's true. Yeah, when Bilquis hooks up, that the, you know, on the show notes, you know, she's credited as being called Bilquis, and you hear him say that name. When he's like, I guess, worshiping her, she's like, hey,
yeah,
worship me.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, like, she's effectively like vagina dentata, right? She's eating him. That's like an old vagina dentata is an old kind of myth that there would be women who have teeth in their vagina.
Sure.
So
not teeth,
you don't know who's
in this case.
Dentata literally means teeth.
Sure, but I'm saying in Bilquis's case, it's more like a swallowing.
Oh, it's not teeth, but it's the idea. Yeah, the idea that they can eat something, eat
yeah,
part of you, or eat all of you. And it was designed, I imagine, to keep men from just kind of like raping women all the time, or like, you know, getting with loose women. But with her, she's able to kind of take the whole man inside of her, and not like just in a sexual way. Like the whole
right
man,
right,
and that just brings us to this other part of the big picture, like introducing Shadow to this world, right?
Right.
So we meet this dude, Shadow. First of all, his name is Shadow. That's weird.
Shadow Moon.
Shadow Moon, right? You've got this big dark guy named Shadow Moon, bald ass head like a moon. I don't know. And you know, he meets these people. He meets Wednesday, who seems to know things about him.
Right.
He meets Sweeney, who pulls coins right out of the air. You know, there's that thing when, in the beginning, again, coming to America, he doesn't get introduced to that, but we do. And it's super crazy. But then, you know, you have this other random thing where this woman someplace far away meets a guy on, like, Tinder or whatever, and she effectively eats him with her vagina. And that, I think, is probably the outlying weird thing that happens in this show. It's like, you don't know who this woman is. You see her. She looks like a normal person. And then she is, like, as naked as it gets. Like, Game of Thrones, early season one naked.
Well, I think that there's a couple things going on here, which I think we will see as sort of an underlying through line in this story, as it was in the book, is that there's one sort of main narrative, which is the story of Shadow. Shadow Moon and Wednesday, and they're, and it's basically a road trip movie, a road trip show, and then you have these sort of disparate glimpses,
these vignettes,
these stories of other characters within this this specialized universe. And yeah, and we're going to keep coming back to that as if this series follows the book in any sort of way, and I know for a fact it does, we are going to keep coming back to that, and then perhaps some of these side characters will then
be fleshed out.
They'll be folded into the main narrative.
Right, and I assume that because that's how we tell stories today. But I do think it remains. If you're a first-time viewer, if you're looking at this pilot, you're like, you get introduced to this guy. You find out that his wife's been, like, you know, hooking up with his best friend, and that's pretty scandalous and very dramatic. Obviously, they don't show you anything about the whole, like, dying in a car crash, giving fellatio. But the first kind of introduction you have to this female, like, you're introduced to this Bilquis female.
Yeah.
You're introduced to her, and then within, you know, a minute, she's, you know, naked as a starling, and she's like making passionate love to this guy, and you know, she's effectively having him worship her. You know, it's a very strange and kinky request. The room is kinky. It's red, right? Like, it's got these candles. And then there's the whole thing where, like, she kind of, you know, it's shot very interestingly. There's no, like, CGI, really. They use some camera effects to show you how she can consume him with her genitals.
It's a real shocker moment. And
right, exactly. That's what I mean. It's a shocker moment. You're kind of like, I just met her, and she ate a guy.
Yeah.
And that's for me.
It does seem sort of out there, like out of nowhere. But I have to say, as we'll get into later on, I have to admire the how faithfully they're sticking to, for the most part, the book. And that is right out of the book. It's you know, when I read that in the book, I'm like, how are they going to put that on the screen exactly? How is that going to work?
Yes. I mean, it's not like pornographic. I mean, it's definitely like R-rated.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're seeing, like, you know, the kind of thing you see in something X-rated. But it is, it's a shocking moment because of the idea of intimacy between two people. I think also because we're used to seeing, even during action shows, right, there might be a woman who has a sexual agency. But this woman begins sort of being like, oh, you think I'm pretty? And then, I don't want to say the word hustles, but she kind of turns the tables on him, and you know, she gets very aggressive, and she
dominates
for it. Yeah, she dominates, but he falls for it, right? He's not like scared. He's not like freaking out. He basically is begging her to eat him up.
Yeah.
And that's what's so interesting and strange. And then, like, then, you know, Shadow gets introduced to the technology boy that Tosin, you and Andy were talking about. The whole faceless man, right?
Yeah.
So in the course of this show, as viewers, you get introduced to a lot of, like, very strange things without kind of them having, like, a thread that connects them together, really.
Not yet, exactly.
And I think that's fairly shocking. And Shadow gets introduced to them.
But isn't
except
that...
for Bilquis, Shadow gets introduced to them pretty clearly.
I mean, isn't that sort of the best part about shows like this, where they can sort of throw all these things at you and not over explain it, and you sort of get everything in context, and if you don't, you trust that you will eventually. So
sure, I completely agree with that. Like, there's mystery here, and that's really important, because who wants to watch a show where everything is sort of like explained right then? In today's world of kind of like long form storytelling designed for maybe even binge watching, you want to have that mystery. So I think they've done a fairly good job with that. I mean, Shadow's also introduced to technology. Boy, do you have anything else to say about him, Andy?
I mean, I think we covered him pretty well, but let's talk about some of our main characters in our show so far. Let's talk about Shadow, for example. This guy is an ex-con, you know, just got out of prison. We know he's got some skills. He's, you know, he's definitely smart enough to practice prestidigitation and be able to fool people with the camera, with his his magic tricks, his coin
tricks.
Yeah,
he's got the coin situation. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what he does with his fingers, right? The whole coin situation.
Yeah, and he had a cellmate in prison, Loki Lysmith, in the show. I don't know if that's the same character from the book, but it's definitely who it is in the show. And this is a guy who's sort of giving him the lowdown on how to get by in on life on the outside once he gets out.
Right, which is interesting because he's also in prison.
Yeah.
And he's in, it looks like Shadow leaves him in prison. So the story he tells is about a guy who effectively got out of jail and, you know, legally, of course. And he goes to an airport, and at the airport, he gets angry and, you know, he gets maybe like a little too violent and they throw him back in jail. And then the conversation between Shadow and his cellmate is, goes something like, Shadow says, "I get it. The kind of behavior that works in a specialized environment such as a prison can fail to work and in fact become harmful when used outside of an environment." And his cellmate, who's quickly becoming a character that we're supposed to care about, says, "No, listen to me. I'm telling you, man. Just don't piss off those bitches in airports," as if the wider story doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it was actually a very interesting bit of dialogue, because from my perspective, I didn't imagine Shadow to be that eloquent in the moment, because everything else he's said has been very sort of basic or stark or short, and then he like goes on this lengthy soliloquy about, like, you know, that's very deep.
Psychology.
And then the response is like pulls you back into where they are. One thing that I did find kind of interesting is his cellmate character, when Shadow has this flashback, he imagines that character walking towards him or walking around in the airport. So
dressed nicely, not as a prison kid, but fitting in with the society. Yeah, but looking like a crazy man, like he looks in his cell.
Right, but that's another of that sort of like dream, what's real versus dream state that we talk about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that's one more thing I'd say about Shadow is Wednesday says this to him. He's like, "You look like a guy who's smart enough to let you're big and you let people think you're dumb when you're not."
Right, right.
It's a paraphrase, but that I think that gives you an idea of kind of how a guy like Wednesday regards Shadow, and that seemed kind of truthful. And then obviously at the same time, you know, Shadow does get in a fight with Mad Sweeney, and that fight is not a small fight. Any of us getting in that fight in the real world will probably gotten kicked out of the bar, right? And it's the kind of fight where people are getting bloody and all that stuff. And it kind of goes to show that as cool-headed as Shadow can kind of be, I mean, his wife died and he's not, like, bawling. He finds out that his wife is maybe, you know, had an affair. He's not bawling. He's still kind of okay, right? It's kind of weird.
Let's talk about some of the other sort of specialized characters. I'm a little loath to say supernatural because we don't know enough about what's going on with them yet.
I think when you eat a person with your vagina, you're supernatural. I'm just saying. I think if you pull coins out of the air, I think that's supernatural.
They're certainly not normal. They belong to a very specialized world. That's for sure.
Unless they're magicians.
Could be. We're not entirely sure where this is going.
You think her bed had a false bottom and that guy's just down there like, "Hey."
Or maybe her vagina is a hat and she's just putting the rabbit back in.
Oh, rabbits.
we talked a little bit about... We talked enough about Wednesday, Mr. Wednesday?
Yeah, I guess we could say about Mr. Wednesday. I mean, he's not... I mean, like, we didn't see anything kind of magical or weird coming out of him. He's a grifter.
Yeah.
He's clever. He uses...
He's very, you know, charismatic and influential. That is for sure, right?
Right. What does he say? He's like, two things about me. I can sleep anywhere. And the second thing, I usually get what I want on average over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about getting people's money. It's about getting them to believe in you. So that was pretty interesting. Then he has this whole conversation about how the plane is flying because people believe the plane flies.
Right.
Not necessarily because of the science. And that was pretty interesting coming from a show that calls itself American Gods, right? This idea of faith. Mm-hmm. Faith in the plane is what keeps the plane in the sky. 82 people.
It's part of the overarching theme. I think that's gonna come into play when we have a discussion about the overall theme for sure, about the movie. I mean, about the show. And I think that's one of those sort of thesis statements, as we like to say, about shows like this, where they're laying out how significant faith is in creating reality.
Right. I mean, that's the paradigm, you know, the for lack of a better term, speaking of a thesis statement, that's the dominant paradigm of how Wednesday sees the world. So that's pretty interesting.
Dwayne, you want to talk about Belquist or get a little bit more into, we did kind of cover her a bit, but like a little bit more into who Belquist is.
Right. So obviously we talked about, you know, who she is in terms of the show, what we've seen of her, but part of what we're doing, because it's called American Gods and because we know the writer Neil Gaiman is kind of obsessed with mythology, is looking into who these people are. So who's Belquist, right? Belquist is another name for the Queen of Sheba. Her name was Belquist. She got with King Solomon. If you think about Ethiopian Jewish people, the idea is that they're supposed to be the children of Sheba, kind of thing. In addition, in many ancient texts, people consider her half woman and half demon, or possibly the queen of demons, related to Lilith, who's a big kind of biblical dark character. And then some rabbis actually denounce her in the Kabbalah, because her son with the king of Israel was Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the temple. So, like, you know, this illicit affair created somebody who actually hurt Israel. So, you know, she's kind of like a baddie, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that she's kind of like, you know, eating men, that's not good either. No one wants to be eaten. So,
if you had to sort of split her into one of two categories, old gods or new gods, she's an old god.
Ancient.
Yes.
Right. Ancient, I mean, god. The First Testament was written at the beginning of civilization for the most part, right? Like at least maybe in the middle, you know, maybe what, 3000 BC? Egyptians are like 6000 BC. So yeah, maybe in the middle. But the bottom line is, a long, long, long time ago. And so she's definitely in that old god space. And why do we use terms like old gods and new gods? That's a big part of the marketing of the show, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's what another theme that both the book and the show is covering. We scratched the surface a little bit of it with Technical Boy and Wednesday and Belquist. And we'll see furthermore how there is, I think we're going to experience the division between the old gods and the new gods, and what that means, what the significance of that is.
Right, but what's really interesting is that even these old gods, the incarnations that we see, mm-hmm. have to live in our modern world, mm-hmm. and that's an mm-hmm. interesting juxtaposition. You know, Technical Boy is modern, so him in our modern world is seamless, but having someone like Belquist in our modern world, or Tosin, you want to talk about Mad Sweeney in our modern world, like what's he about?
Yeah, Mad Sweeney is a pretty fantastic character and kind of one of the guys I latched to in this first episode. Mad Sweeney's a leprechaun, or so he claims, although he is a bit tall for one, and just calls there's this funny interaction where Shadow says, hey, you know, aren't you a little too tall for a leprechaun? And he just waves it off as short being a stereotype that's always given. He, you know, drinks Southern Comfort and Coke, so not like Jameson or other Irish whiskey.
Right, like you think a leprechaun would go for the Irish whiskey, the Catholic whiskey, and he's going for, you know, Southern Comfort and Coke, which is a very American drink, but that kind of goes to show, what's the show called? Yeah. American Gods.
American Gods, exactly. And he somehow is either a really good magician or a leprechaun, as he says, because he continually starts pulling gold out of the air. And I think part of that really sort of surprises Shadow and makes Shadow even more curious, but also annoys him too, because he is, like, you know, sort of manipulating coins around Shadow, and Shadow, who takes himself to be fairly fairly proficient in the act of like magic and coin illusions and misdirection, really cannot compare to Matt Sweeney is doing.
And Sweeney's flaunting it. That's part of the thing too, right? He's like, he's not just doing a coin trick. He's like, I'm pulling it from your face. I'm pulling it from behind your ear. I'm doing all this like stuff.
Flipping one up and waiting for it to come down at the perfect moment.
He takes Shadow's favorite coin. He flips it up in the air. And Shadow's like waiting for it to come down. And like it doesn't come down. And Sweeney just kind of moves on. So there's like definitely this flaunting showmanship thing. And that really builds the foundation for the fight they have later.
Yeah. And then, of course, as sort of a backdrop to to Shadow making sort of his commitment to Wednesday, you see Sweeney in the background, like just nailing the center of the dartboard constantly, trying to, trying to figure out, hey, is he just really lucky or is he just extremely skillful at this game?
And we have one more sort of supernatural person. We don't know if they're a god or not. Maybe we're assuming that perhaps they're one of the new gods, if we're talking about old gods and new gods, and that is Technical Boy. He's sort of the god of computers and the internet. In his speech to Shadow Moon in the limo, he talks about how these new gods should prevail over the old gods, that they're going to be taking over and the old gods are dead. It's all about the dominant paradigm, which is where, in fact, the name of our podcast comes from. And this guy he's like new money, you know, he's brash. He's
tacky.
Yes, exactly. It's new money, and I think that's the this show's way of personifying a new god. It's just, you know, it's sort of
he's
gross.
Got so much power, he doesn't even know what to
indulgence.
Do with it.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, he's smoking. What's the thing he's got? He's smoking what he calls synthetic toad skins.
Yep.
So it's like weed isn't good enough for him. He's got to get that thing. That is just so out there and so high society, high class that you don't even know about it. It's like the guy mm-hmm. who only listens to bands before they get popular.
Yeah. It's and in the book, it's described as smelling like electronics burning. So.
Right. So he's like internet and IoT.
Yeah.
He's like the actual devices and the stuff online.
Yeah.
So you're saying he's a representation of AOL and my modems and then. let's just cover him in AOL disks.
Oh wow, that's freaky.
All right, before we take a break here and talk about the differences between the show and the book a little bit, let's talk briefly about some of the overall themes here. There was a quote by George Eliot, the poet George Eliot. Our dead are never dead to us until we have forgotten them, which is sort of a reference to an ancient Egyptian concept that once your name is erased from all writing and removed from people's memories, then your soul actually dies. And I feel like that is conceptually
what we're saying, right? Like he was saying, delete, like, you know, we're going to erase everything about you guys and there's no such thing as undelete.
Right. Right. And that is and we're going to see that. I think we're going to see that throughout this show. I think that's the core theme of this show. And it's certainly one of the core themes of Neil Gaiman's book is that when the gods die, the gods will truly die when they are forgotten. And when the gods are brought over from one country to another and kept in the memory in current memory, they continue to live.
They flourish.
To flourish on.
Yeah. Well, she's also interesting because, you know, if you think about the way Christianity works, you know, God made us to love him, right?
Yeah.
And that is the kind of favor that, frankly, all gods throughout history have had, right? Some gods want sacrifices, you know, of flesh. Some gods want sacrifices of items like food or whatever. But all that is about gaining favor with those gods. And that's what makes those gods powerful in the eyes of their people. When it comes to the erasure of memory, of ideas, of people or or kind of gods. There is a longstanding idea in sociology that heaven is sort of your impact on society. So if you're a person like Abraham Lincoln, right, your lasting impact on society is sort of your redemption. It's like a theory that floats around in there. The fact that we think about Abraham Lincoln and that he, changed the country. I mean, used to typically refer to the United States, they'd say, like, the United States are going to do something. After Lincoln, it was the United States is going to do something. He consolidated the power in the federal government. He did all these things. But one of the things about that is that his impact on society was so much that he won't be forgotten for God knows how long.
Yeah.
And that means that he has sort of an afterlife as opposed to sort of the typical stuff you find in mythology and the Bible and so on and so forth. So there's something in social science that's an analog to what these Egyptians were talking about and what George Eliot was talking about.
All right, we're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the differences between the first episode here and what we see in the book, and then some random stuff, and then we are going to wrap it up.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about henna, 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 Aiko, Aiko, Ande, Giacomo Fino, Anane, Giacomo Finane. Look at my king all dressed in red, Aiko, Aiko, Ande, I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead, Giacomo Finane. Talking about henna,
welcome back to The Dominant Paradigm. We're talking about the first episode of American Gods called The Bone Orchard. Let's talk about some of the differences between the Neil Gaiman's book and the first episode of American Gods.
Yeah, so to start off, the inmates wanting to hang Shadow, that's not something that I really recall being called out in the book. To be honest, it seemed like Shadow was fairly low-key. He had one goal, which was to essentially survive and get out of prison. Wait till
your own time.
Yeah, do your own time is a mantra that he kept repeating. And in the film, it seems overly aggressive and without any real sort of purpose. It seemed like a kind of a throwaway, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Another change is when we see that white buffalo throughout the course of the book, there's an individual that you know as the Buffalo Man. It mm-hmm. now appears that he may be represented now by an actual creature.
Yeah,
that's to be determined. That's where what it seems to be hinting towards.
This the white bison with the fire coming out of his eyes and the smoke coming out of his mouth. It was used as the big PR thing during South by Southwest when Tom Chernar were down there.
This to me feels like a little bit of a Brian Fuller device because he did essentially the same thing in the Hannibal series. With a black elk, he had this sort of motif of a black elf who would go through dream sequences throughout the series, and that black elk represented both death and Hannibal Lecter as a person. So I think
I like it.
Yeah, yeah,
I
mean, it's cool. It's,
I really
it's,
like.
It's fascinating.
I now I have to go chase down Hannibal because I want to see this elk in action. So,
but yeah, I like.
Listen, what else you got?
Yeah, so the last thing I have here is Shadow being released 3 years early on a 6-year sentence is typically what was going on in the book, and here he's just being released, no parole. They moved very quickly through that whole sequence in the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think in the book we figured out, Tosin and I were talking today, 15 pages, Shadow's out of jail. So 15 pages feels like, what, 3-4 minutes? I could see that happening. Andy, what do you have from changes from the book?
Well, in the book, when they describe Bilquis, she is a prostitute. And in the first episode, at the very least, I don't know if it this if it pans out that she ends up being a prostitute in further episodes, but in the first episode, she's finding dates using a dating app like Tinder. I think they even mention Tinder by name. So that's how she finds her perspective dates slash victims slash, you know, supplicants. In the book, it's when we're talking about the mead, when Wednesday is offering Shadow Moon the mead to sort of seal the deal. Second seals the deal. The third is the charm. In the book, it's not shots of mead. It's actual like drinks of mead.
It's like whole glasses.
Whole glasses.
Of gross.
Mead. also, after the fight with Mad Sweeney, Shadow passes out and isn't knocked out by Mad Sweeney. It's a minor change, but I think it's just one of those small differences. And Mr. Wednesday now has given his car a name in the series, Betty, and I don't recall it being named such in the book.
No, in the book, they definitely they kind of picked up and dumped cars left and right. Yeah. So they did this cars. You know, you look at this car that they've chosen for the show, the whole open road motif, the beautiful, you know, 1960s or 70s vehicle. It's a character. Like, the car is a character. It's not a god or anything, but it's definitely kind of like how the Enterprise is a character in Star Trek.
I think it's an interesting. I mean, I think it's a way of sort of making a hero car. You know, whereas in the book you had,
that's what I mean,
right? So it's a stylistic choice, and I think it's a good one.
It's a beautiful visual choice. Yeah, I really enjoy it. It also goes very well with the character that we know of Wednesday so far in this first episode. Other things that are different from the book. Wednesday, speaking of cars, Wednesday, when Shadow wakes up in the back of Betty, he's like, "Hey, where'd you put my car?" And Wednesday says, "Oh, I ditched it," which could cause problems for an ex-con. And you'd think that this guy would want this ex-con not having, like, law enforcement or whatever, bill collectors chasing him. In the book, he says he had Mad Sweeney take it back for him. If we want to go back to the beginning of the story, in the book, you know, Audrey, who tries to hook up with Shadow, she spits on Laura's face during the wake or the funeral or the open casket bit in the church. And that's not depicted here. Also, the whole like attempt of a blowjob in the graveyard, not happening in the book at all, and the whole lowering of the casket also didn't happen. So that whole sequence was kind of reinvented for TV, much like Betty as a visual aid. They're reinventing a lot of these pieces for TV, and I don't think they're doing a bad job. I'm not like mad at these things, but they're worth noting because it changes a bit of the tenor, but it also modernizes it too. The Betty Gilpin, who's playing Audrey, is doing a pretty fantastic job. The whole Percocet drunk slur thing, mm-hmm, while mm-hmm. trying to get back her dignity by saying these completely like filthy things to Shadow over the grave of his
She's
wife.
Fantastic actress, Betty Gilpin.
Yeah, I mean, it was really something. I was so impressed. From the time I saw the pilot of South by Southwest to looking at it again to record this show. And Andy, you have Tosin, you have a couple more things you want to mention.
Yeah, so one is the technical boy. He actually is a much larger figure individual, fat in the book, and here he's more sort of skinny in terms of look. And then in the book itself, I don't recall that Shadow was ever lynched. Especially, what happens is, you know, Technical Boy essentially tells Shadow that he needs to relay the message that, you know, the old gods are
on the outs.
Yeah, are on the outs and won't win to Wednesday, and like shoves him, you know, drops him off actually. And in this, like, the Technical Boy is like, okay, we're gonna kill you. And there's this whole lynching thing that, you know, didn't happen in the book. So,
yeah, I mean, that was definitely like a jarring and surprising thing to happen. But now a quick random thing. In the pilot TV show, Shadow doesn't have enough money to get the chili and the burger. And the waitress that comes up to her name is Beth Grant. She's a waitress of the Crocodile Bar.
The actress.
Yeah, the actress. I'm sorry. The actress that shows up, her name is Beth Grant. She plays the waitress in the Crocodile Bar. In the credits, it shows that she owns it, so that's interesting. But the fun fact is that if you ever watch Speed 1994, she's the annoying older lady that forces Sandra Bullock to kind of get up from the bus in the beginning and say, "Oh my God, I've got gum on my seat. Gum." And that's stuck in my head for the last 23 years.
You had to let it out. Also,
I saw that face and I was like, "Oh my God!" I looked at my wife. She's like, "Speed," and
the gum
I had to
lady.
Go look it up and find her. And later on in the movie Speed, she's like, "I have to get off the bus." And she tries to get off, and she gets killed because she, you know, blows up because she's annoying. But I really, really, really enjoyed seeing her on screen. So Beth Grant, thank you.
Yeah,
she's also actually interesting. That reminds me of another chain. Very minor, though, right? Wednesday in the bar actually pays for Shadow's food. They kind of redirect him to the table that Wednesday is sitting at in the book, and that's a little different here.
That's helpful because I'm sure Wednesday didn't stiff her on the tip, so it was okay that they made a mess.
All right, let's talk about before we wrap it up here. Let's talk about what your guys' thoughts were of the overall sort of the technical presentation of the episode, like, you know, art direction, acting performances, music, etc. What did you guys think about? Well, first of all, let me just start by saying that Brian Fuller is the executive producer of this show, and Brian Fuller has had a career obsession with death. And dark, gruesome things, even when done in a very sort of humorous bent. He did Wonderfalls, Pushing Daisies, Hannibal. I want to say that he also did Dead Like Me. Is that correct?
Mm.
So he's got this career of being of this obsession with death, and this is very much falling in line with that, and you can see a lot of influence of Hannibal on American Gods throughout this, particularly in the very lush art direction, and it was a hallmark of Hannibal, and it's a hallmark continuing forward with American Gods. Acting, I think, fantastic. I mean, we talked briefly off the show, but let's talk about it now about the casting of Wednesday, of
Ian McShane.
Yeah, Ian McShane.
He was on Game of Thrones as a small character, playing a maester.
But he's mostly well known for
Deadwood on HBO, another HBO series where he played a kind of bar owner. Yeah, the basically the big businessman of the town, Al Swearingen. He was fantastic. And this character Wednesday is on some level, you know, McShane is touching a little bit on Swearingen, but not really. Wednesday's a very different character, and I think he's actually able to pull this off pretty powerfully. And not to mention Ricky Whittle, the guy playing Shadow. He played on a TV show called The 100, very popular TV show designed kind of as a TV version of the dystopian stuff you see when it comes to The Hunger Games or Allegiant, Divergent kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he played a character called Lincoln, who was sort of a native to the destroyed Earth, fall in love with another with a woman, and who had come down from the space station, yada yada yada, kind of like Romeo and Juliet kind of thing. And at no time did it seem trite. And seeing him in this capacity, you know, not covered in mud and dirt all the time, not kind of like gone native, but, you know, in a suit and everything, pretty powerful representation of Shadow, much more kind of dignified, I think, than I completely imagined him earlier on. And then obviously there's Bilquis. She's played by an actress named Itidi Badaki. Saw her, and, you know, obviously she comes out of nowhere. Her character isn't quite related to everybody else yet, but this is the first time I saw her on screen. In person, she's actually fairly small and really unassuming. I actually caught her on the flight back to Denver when I was leaving South by Southwest. Saw her, and I think her performance is one that shows this interesting power and also this vulnerability, right? She's looking for attention, love, whatever. And at the same time, she does the hustle where she's completely in charge later. So I thought that was pretty powerful. I haven't seen her in a lot of stuff, but I do think that if she can hold on to the character the way she's holding on to it now, we'll see some interesting things coming out of her as well. So I think there's the cast is ensemble, and it's got some, you know, even Betty Gilpin was on Nurse Jackie for many seasons. And this cast knows what it's doing. It's not just kind of out of nowhere, which is necessary for a story that's based on characters that are thousands of years old in some cases. So that's pretty good. But Andy, you wanted to talk about the music, and Tosin, you had something to say about that too?
Yeah, the music is very reminiscent, again, of previous Brian Fuller show, Hannibal, because it's the same composer, Brian Reitzell, who did the music. And Reitzell's music for Hannibal was very ethereal, moody, and punctuated with unique sort of instruments that are non-traditional. And you get a lot of that here in American Gods as well.
I feel like with this show, there are times, or at least with the pilot episode, and keep in mind that it is a pilot, there are times when the music feels a little off with what's happening, and maybe some of this is based off of, you know, how I read and depicted the book. The music, as well as some of the direction where it's, you know, we're seeing all of this bloodbath, and it's more sort of stylized and very, as we keep repeating, 300-esque. It just doesn't... It's a bit jarring from what I expected. I don't know how you got... Did you guys feel the same way or differently?
I definitely felt that the music lent an air of disquiet, which I think was... Which, to me, felt like the intention. So...
Yeah, it definitely... I mean, there are those moments when I was thrown off, you know, during dream sequences or that whole Norwegian, Norse mythology kind of thing with the arrows and all that stuff. And it didn't seem congruent to me. I get what you're saying, Tosin. Music, high quality, but it didn't always seem congruent to me. I have a feeling there's a little bit of pilot disease in there. The pilots of these shows are, you know, they're trying to figure out who they are and everything. Yeah. So, I'm not too worried about it, but I do see what you're saying.
Let's talk about what we hope to see in the upcoming episode, in the next episode, and perhaps in the series. Now, Tosin, what do you feel like you want to see in the next episode following this one?
Well, hopefully we'll figure out what happened with Shadow, why there are all these, you know, who's the one who's cutting these creatures up in half, and like what's going on there, and then. Digging a little bit more into what Wednesday's mission is, because it seems like there's some sort of journey or task that they have ahead of them. So let's continue that mystery or that journey. What about yourself, Dwayne?
I'm looking to see how it diverges itself from the book. I'm excited to see how it's going to do that and make those decisions. I think stylistically, we're in pretty good shape. I'm not disappointed. I think the cast again is pretty powerful. So I'm mostly excited about what's happening here, and I'm ready for it to kind of move forward. I think the big thing here is that Gaiman, the writer of the original story book, is pretty melancholic when he writes. Right, things are kind of like down and sad, and you don't necessarily have an action scene every episode. But TV shows kind of have to do that. So how they get past the drama, how they get through the story, making it interesting and keeping it thought-provoking, but also having sort of a climax every episode, that's what I'm looking for.
Should we talk about some of the things that may help other people to appreciate the show more, as far as like external things, external books, external links, external references that might enhance your enjoyment of the show? First of all, I want to talk about Neil Gaiman's recently published Norse mythology book. No book more than this one is one that I would say is required reading for enjoying American Gods moving forward. Norse mythology in general, and Norse mythology in in particular seems to be a real passion of Neil Gaiman's, and it shows in his love of it. In Norse mythology, he goes extensively into the tales about Odin and Thor and Loki, and I feel like you'll see a lot of that in upcoming episodes. So that's definitely one to check out.
Right, check out Koala on the Queen of Sheba, Queen of the South. See what they have to say. You know, it's an ancient book that's constantly being updated by Jewish rabbis and scholars. Take a look at what they have to say about the Queen of Sheba, and then you know, if you want to learn a little bit about Mads Sweeney, his name comes from an old Irish text called The Madness of Sweeney. Right, Suibhne, which can be pronounced Sweeney, I imagine, but it's Irish Gaelic. It's pretty cool, and it's part of a little ring cycle of stories. So that's pretty tight. And basically, in the story, you get to kind of understand how a character would come to be named Mads Sweeney. Tosin, you got a couple films for people to watch.
Yeah, so for in terms of films, we've got The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions. I personally don't think they're the greatest films, but you'll see a lot of those sort of themes, and you see some of the similar sort of action beats. And another film that we've been repeating on and on is 300. So 300, as well as potentially the sequels, if you care to suffer through some of those. Those are films that you can check out and kind of see what we're talking about when we talk about how combat is currently flowing in at least the pilot.
All right, and that's going to do it for this first episode of The Dominant Paradigm, discussing American Gods, episode one, The Bone Orchard. We'll be back next week to discuss the second episode of American Gods, which is titled The Secret of Spoon. That should be an interesting one if my knowledge of the book is any guide. So join us for the day after this episode airs, and that's it for this episode of The Dominant Paradigm. We'll see you guys next week.